welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. The next hour is the finale of our look at the life and career of astronaut Alan Bean, who was the fourth man to walk on the moon as the lunar module pilot on Apollo 12. He also was the commander of the Skylab 3 mission, which orbited the Earth for 59 and a half days in 1973. After his NASA career, Bean poured himself heart and soul into something he was deeply in love with, art. He was a masterful oil painter, and his depictions of many aspects of the Apollo missions to the moon are, in a way, as or perhaps more instructive than the photographs and video taken on the moon missions. And oh yeah, cameras. Bean had some bad luck with the TV camera on Apollo 12, accidentally frying the video tube and rendering it useless for the mission. I always wondered if it might not have been that was a driving force for his magnificent paintings. He wanted us all to see and feel the things that he experienced on the moon. Later in the program, we'll talk to my good friend, Andrew Chaikin. Andy is the author of the definitive book about the Apollo astronauts, A Man on the Moon. Andy also met Al Bean as a kid and maintained a close relationship with the astronaut after interviewing him extensively for his book. But first, let's talk to one of Al Bean's best friends and colleagues, Rusty Schweikart. Rusty was the lunar module pilot on Apollo 9, and along with Commander Jim McDivitt, test flew the first lunar module in space in the spring of 1969. Along with Walt Cunningham and Bean, Rusty was a member of the third astronaut group selected in October of 1963. Rusty Schweikart, welcome to Blue Dot. And of course, we're here to talk about your good friend and colleague, the late, and it makes me sad to say that, Alan Bean. Could you just start by sharing with us, when did you first meet Alan Bean, and when did you start to form a friendship with him? Because I know you did.
Yeah, I think I met Alan first during our selection process in the third group of astronauts. Don't remember exactly which of the different occasions during the selection process it happened, but I do remember meeting him there. But we really became close friends, or kind of a subgroup of four of us in the 13. We used to call ourselves the Four Musketeers, and Walt Cunningham, Bill Anders, myself, and Alan were sort of the Four Musketeers in the group, and we sort of hung out together during the early training days, and that was when we got pretty close. But we remained close, until the week before he died, when we were talking on the phone that week.
So it was a week before was the last time you talked to him?
Yeah, he had called because he was going up to Indiana, and he was going to be giving a kind of tribute to Roger Chaffee. And Roger lived right across the street from me in Texas, in Nassau Bay. And Alan was looking for anecdotes about Roger, little tidbits that I could share with him so that he could, kind of dig at Roger.
And of course, Roger was killed in the terrible fire in Apollo 1, and also flew, as I recall, the U-2 spy missions over Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Now you're telling me something I didn't know about Roger.
Yeah, no, that's true. I would like you to tell us a bit about Alan Bean as an astronaut. Give us an assessment of his career as an astronaut from your perspective.
Well, Alan was an interesting personality. I mean, he was a heck of a good pilot. I mean, every time, we enjoyed flying together. Every time we flew in the T-38s or the T-33, that we used for traveling around the country during our training days and all of that. So I never flew with Alan in the Navy, but I certainly did a lot of flying with him, and was always very impressed with his capability. Personality wise, Alan was, I guess I would say, intense, to some extent, even single minded. That showed up more when he became an artist and started focusing on his painting. But it was there while he was an astronaut as well. And for that matter, it was there day to day in just personal interactions. He was a great guy. It was unique. He had a great sense of humor, kind of an explosive laugh, which was always fun because we would, you know, whenever we connected all through life, I mean, even our last phone conversation, we were just yucking it up. And Alan has that classic laugh that probably started when he was a teenager.
And the Apollo 12 mission, which was, of course, was the second landing on the moon. And, of course, that made him the fourth person to walk on the moon. That crew, it's always been characterized as being extremely tight-knit and close, with Pete Conrad as the commander and Dick Gordon as the command module pilot, both the veterans of the crew, if you will, and then Alan Bean as kind of the rookie. Would you characterize them that way? Was that your observation too?
Oh, yeah. Well, and of course, the three of them were the backup for Jim McDivitt, Dave Scott, and I on Apollo 9 as well. So we spent a lot of time with all, you know, all six of us together, you know, flying around the country to different places to get ready for the missions and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, they were very tight, you know, as all six of us were. I mean, we were very intense time getting ready for a complicated mission. You know, I can tell you one story from Apollo 12, which really, every time I think about it, kind of blows me away. I don't know if you want that or not.
Sure.
Well, I remember during their mission on the moon, I think at the time I'm thinking when they first came out of the lunar module, I was at Pete Conrad's house with his wife, Jane, at the time. To help explaining what was going on to her, you know, as they were running around the moon. But I remember that they had what we called an ALSEP package, that science package, Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package. And that package of scientific experiments was to be powered by a thermal electric generator that was powered by a nuclear fuel rod. And that nuclear fuel rod was stored on the outside of the lunar module in a carbon cask, a sort of a cylindrical container that was probably almost a foot in diameter and probably 2 or 2.5 feet long. And one of the first things they had to do when they got out of the lunar module was to lower that cask to the point where it was pointing down toward them, standing on the ground behind the LEM. And they would then, Alan would screw a handle into the end of that fuel rod. It was pretty hot, and he'd have to screw this handle into the end of it and then pull it out of the cask before inserting it in the thermal generator in the experiment package. And when they got to do that, Alan pulled on the handle after he got it screwed in, and it wouldn't come out. And in the end, Pete Conrad got a hold of he had their geology hammer, and he started whacking on the fuel cask on the outside of the cask and yelling at Alan to pull harder, you know. And I got thinking, what in the world could be crazier than this? Two of my buddies, in real time, I'm watching them on television, up on the moon, beating on a nuclear fuel rod with a hammer. I mean, how crazy is that, right?
Wow. Yeah.
Every time I think about that, it's like, this is reality. How can that be? I mean, it's just an amazing moment, you know?
And of course, there was also the moment right after launch when they had been struck by lightning and they completely lost their navigation platform. The computer just, you know, zapped out. And it was Alan Bean that figured out, you know, when he was told which switch to flip to get everything back online, wasn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, before that moment when they finally got everything back online, I mean, you know, lightning hit them, and every warning light and buzzer and siren and thing in the whole spacecraft kind of sequentially went off, you know, beep beep, flash flash, and it got you know, when the first one happened, you know, but that's like the first millisecond it happened, you know, Alan, of course, is looking around trying to figure out what in the world's going on. And of course, immediately after that, all kinds of lights and things are going on. And there was no simulation that we ever had that was that bad. I mean, it was impossible. And it got so bad. And this is almost more Pete than Alan, although Alan joined right in. I mean, Pete just started laughing. It got so ridiculous. And of course, they were still going up. Everything was fine because the launch vehicle was actually in control, not the spacecraft. But normally you're monitoring everything that's happening to make sure it's going right. And they just lost everything. And then finally, you know, the mission control called up to him to say, well, we don't know, but give a shot at throwing the SCE switch and see if that works. Alan threw the switch and all of a sudden everything was okay again.
Yeah, the famous SCE to auxiliary. And he knew what that was.
Oh, yeah. You do a lot of training. You know where all those switches are. But but which one to throw in a mess like that was anybody's guess.
And where were you at that moment? You weren't at Jane Conrad's house then, were you?
I don't really know where I might have been down at the Cape. Yeah, I think I was. Yeah, I was at the Cape because I had I actually had the Aga Khan and his at that time fiance there, and we were watching their launch.
Wow! And did you didn't see it get hit by lightning, did you? That we kind of found out that later. Was that how that worked?
Yeah, it wasn't cloud to ground lightning. It actually went cloud to spacecraft and then to ground. In other words, the lightning bolt kind of went through the spacecraft on the way to get to the ground. You couldn't really see it because they were up in the clouds by that time, or just barely in the cloud by that time. Nobody has ever had an experience like that one since or before. That was a crazy time.
And of course, the worry would be that, you know, they had damaged the pyrotechnics that would fire their parachutes and they would not be able to come back to Earth.
Yeah, well, that was sort of not back to John Glenn. You know, I mean, for a while a question. I think Mission Control pretty much decided that, no, it wouldn't have hurt that. But or the parachutes would have been out during the launch.
Ooh, yeah. Wow. You're listening to Blue Dot from NSPR. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Rusty Schweikart as we look back at the life of Apollo astronaut and artist Alan Bean. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return to my interview with Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Schweikart as we look back at the life of his friend and colleague, Alan Bean. Tell us something about him as a person that really stands out to you. You know, when you think back about your friend, what was the thing you loved the most about him?
Well, you know, for me, the thing that was so special about Alan was his curiosity. He was always curious about what was going on. And I was kind of I was a liberal in the astronaut office, right? And so Alan, every time we would talk for years after we were in the astronaut office together, but even while we were in the office together, Alan always wanted to know what I was thinking. What was I doing? because I was always doing things a little different from other people. And Alan was always curious about it. He wanted to know what was happening, what I was thinking, and why was I thinking that. And it wasn't that he wanted to argue, because, you know, he never did argue his point of view. He just wanted to understand what was happening in somebody else's mind. And somehow he wanted to integrate that with his thinking too. He didn't often change his mind, to agree with me, but he never argued his point of view. He was really just curious. It was almost as if he tried to live your experience, even though he wasn't you, you know, but he wanted to understand why you did what you did. It was really a fascinating thing. And I think in a way that ended up being in his paintings too, because he finally got around to the point where he realized. I mean, I remember right after he started painting, I went over to his house one time. I guess I was somewhere else, but I was visiting Houston, and I went over to visit with Alan, and he was showing me his paintings. And this was in the early days of his artistry. And I looked at him and I thought, you know, these are really interesting paintings. Number one, technically they were okay, good, in fact, but they were like you painted a photograph, and he was trying to make them photographic. And I looked at him and I sort of said, well, Alan, you know, artists paint what they feel about something, not just the reality of it. And you're a good enough artist. You ought to be doing that. And he kind of looked at me and said, that's an interesting thought. And I don't know when, but it was, you know, sometime after that, I noticed that in his paintings, you know, the moon wasn't just gray. He would use colors, and he would actually finally got around to painting things that really weren't on the moon, that didn't happen on the moon, but things, what they would have looked like in a way artistically had they actually happened. So it was really great to see finally his personality actually get into his paintings. That was wonderful.
Wow, that's, you know, kind of the evolution of an artist in of any kind is going from mere, you know, representation of something to interpreting how you think and feel about it.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I never thought about it with all artists, but that's probably, you're right, it's probably true.
They tend to go through a kind of a sequence of copying somebody that they've, you know, always admired, and then finding their own voice or their own vision. That tends to be
probably a matter of building confidence in your ability, you know. And I was happy to, you know, give him an attaboy and sick him on some interpretation.
This is kind of putting you on the spot because it's a difficult question, but can you think of anything fun or humorous anecdote you could share with us about him? And if you can, it's okay.
Oh, yeah, sure. In fact, it was really weird about Alan. As long as I knew him, although I guess when I think about it, we didn't eat together very much in later years. But certainly when he was backing up our crew and when we were working together on Skylab, and we would, you know, catch lunch somewhere at a fast food restaurant or whatever, Alan always drank iced tea. I mean, Alan was, among other things, a creature of habit. And once he formed a habit, man, you know, it lasted, and it never very seldom varied. And Alan loved his iced tea for lunch, but it had to be very light and the glass had to be filled with ice. And I cannot tell you how many times I saw an iced tea sent back to the kitchen that was slightly too dark or that didn't have ice right to the top. I mean, and those of us that ate with him you could predict it. It was just a riot. You know, you see the waiter coming out with iced tea, and it was, uh-oh, here we go.
Oh, that's funny. And I do recall that he also was, like, fond of eating, like, spaghetti every day.
Yeah, that's right. He loves spaghetti, man. Alan was a creature of habit. he was always curious about things, but when he formed an opinion or when he took a position on something, he didn't argue about it, but he was strong on it. It was interesting.
What will you miss most about him?
Dave, just the fact that Alan and I could go for a year without talking. We'd pick up the phone and call the other one, and we'd be right back together. I mean, it was like a brother. I mean, you know, there was no delay time in getting back into familiar territory. We would just immediately start laughing and yucking it up and talking about somebody or some event or whatever it was. I mean, you know, he was one of my best friends in my life. And I mean, the fact that I spoke with him, I'm so glad that we talked the week before he died. I mean, it was, or the week before he went up to Indiana. And it was just, you know, he was a special, special person. And I don't think there's anybody that I've ever missed as much as I miss Alan. I mean, he was just a wonderful guy.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your memories of your dear friend and colleague. It's been wonderful to be able to talk to you about it.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to have done it. I mean, just there's no tribute enough. You know, he's just wonderful. I miss him dearly.
Thanks to Apollo 9 astronaut and close friend of Alan Bean's, Rusty Schweikart. Next, we're going to talk to Andrew Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon. But before we do, let's listen to a bit of audio of Al Bean and Pete Conrad on Oceanus Procellarum, The Ocean of Storms. In it, Bean is asking Houston about the colors he's observing both on the moon and especially on the Surveyor 3 spacecraft, which has sat on the moon awaiting their inspection for 2 years. I think it's interesting to note his observational skill and sense of color foreshadowing the artwork that he would go on to create.
Yeah, that's the first time we've seen that. In fact, you know what it looks like here? It looks like it may be this darker material. Well, I don't know. I'm going to photograph that, too. Let me get, okay. Let me get this. Yeah, Houston, kind of interesting here. Pete walked across one edge of the rim here, and we're about, 50 feet inside the upper rim, and he happened to scrape an area there with his foot into a much lighter colored soil, like cement. Beautiful sight. No, this was brown, and I don't remember ever seeing brown there at the Cape. Kind of a light tan, or maybe that's the way it changed color. What color was this one? Houston, white? What started out?
Stand by on that.
Yeah, it looks a light tan now. Yeah, this crater isn't as steep as we thought, Pete. I better be careful. I'm going to get dust on it. Yeah. I'll stop here and just leave a last picture.
Now, the equipment bays were white on the side, and the scoop itself was a light blue.
Well, it's kind of we'll get down there and get close inspection. What was the general color of all the structures? For example, all the struts and the lights.
That's all white. The equipment bays and the primary structure is all painted with a white paint.
Pretty good tan or something. We have to look at it more closely. No, that's what happened. It changed color, huh? Sure has. That's cut that paint brown.
Alan Bean and Pete Conrad on the surface of the moon, November 1969. Now let's hear from another friend of Alan Bean's and his fellow author on Apollo, an eyewitness account, Andrew Chaikin. Andy's seminal work, A Man on the Moon, served as the basis of the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. One episode, That's All There Is, tells the story of Apollo 12 through the experiences of Al Bean as portrayed by actor Dave Foley. Andy Chaikin, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you, David.
You were just talking to me a little bit before we went on the air, that he was the first astronaut you ever met?
Yeah, that's right. I was 12 years old, going on 13. It was the spring of 1969, and my parents, as an advance birthday present, took me down to visit the Space Center in Florida, the Kennedy Space Center. And just by divine providence or luck or whatever you want to call it, we stayed at the same motel where the astronauts stayed when they were training. And the lady who ran the hotel was very kind to me, could see that I was just absolutely busting out as a young space fanatic, and I was dying to meet an astronaut. And I could tell that there were astronauts there because there were signed pictures all over the lobby. And she said to me, well, if you go out very early tomorrow morning in the parking lot, you might just meet an astronaut. So I was out there with my drawing pad and my pencil, and I had done a sketch of the Apollo spacecraft on the flight down. And the first one out of the door, out of any of the doors, was Alan Bean. And I recognized him, and he was very kind to me and signed my drawing pad and introduced me to his backup astronaut, Jim Irwin, because Alan had just been assigned as the lunar module pilot for Apollo 12. He'd just come off backing up Apollo 9. And then that evening, Alan invited me to visit him in his room, where he gave me a copy of the command module instrument panel chart that he had been using to train, and he'd signed it for me. And it was just so amazing. And just so generous and so kind. And that would turn out to be the hallmark of my experience of Alan Bean all through his life and mine. When I interviewed him for A Man on the Moon many, many years later, he was just such a fantastic person to interview, took me inside his experiences, his thoughts and feelings. And again, the thing, and really I would have to say, became a kind of mentor to me. We stayed in touch. We were very closely in touch over the years, and I would see him at least every once a year. Saw him most recently last December in Houston. It was Alan's kindness and his generosity that I think made the greatest impact on me, and indeed on many, many other people. I think that was the thing that so characterized him as a public figure, you know, to be experiencing that kind of fame and have so many people want to talk to you. And, you know, he was always willing to give so much of himself. And I'll always remember that. I'll always cherish that.
And it's interesting, you think about life's events, and I wonder, listening to that story, if you hadn't have stayed in that motel, if you hadn't have had that meeting and that personal encounter, your life could have turned out so very different.
I'm not sure that my life would have turned out differently, because I was really boresighted on doing something related to space. But what it did was it gave me a sense of a thread, this wonderful storyline that stretched all the way back to my childhood. So my connection to Alan stretched all the way back to that time. And then Alan was one of the first people that I did interview in detail about the experience of going to the moon. And it just all felt like part of the same life story for me. It just felt like, you know, I feel like I've had some help.
I'm sure you also have the sense that you weren't the only kid that he ever treated that way.
Right. And, you know, we've laughed about that. I mean, I've reminded him of that story. In fact, a couple of years ago, I was telling him about that story, and he stopped, and how he invited me to his room and gave me the panel chart. And he said, huh, I guess it must have been nicer then. you know, that's a kind of self-deprecating humor on his part, because you talk to anybody who's run into him at a space convention where people are lined up to get his autograph, people who have encountered him in art galleries when he's been giving a show, people who've written to him out of the blue, who've never met him before, and they will all tell you the same thing about how kind he was and how generous he was. So there's this enormous way in which Alan touched people through his own spirit. But there's another thing too, and this came out in my conversations with him. The thing about Alan is he was always grateful for what he had. He came back from the moon and said to himself, you know, first of all, he said, I'm going to live my life the way I want to live it now. You know, he told himself that in lunar orbit, actually. If I get out of this, when I get out of this, I'm going to live my life the way I want to. And so he stayed at NASA for several more years. He flew as the commander of the second Skylab visit in 1973. And then just around the time the space shuttle started flying, he decided to leave and pursue art. And, you know, that was true to the promise he'd made himself. That was what he wanted to do. And he didn't worry that other people might think it was a little bit odd. I mean, I think he had covered his bases, that he had enough resources set aside that he could give this a try and see if he could make a living out of art. And by God, he did. But the thing that he would tell me and everybody else who interviewed him is that when he came back from the moon, he no longer complained about things like it might be a rainy day or there might be traffic on the roads, you know, and delaying him from getting wherever he was going. He just felt grateful. He felt grateful for his life. He felt grateful to be on planet Earth. He said at one point, Earth is the Garden of Eden. He'd seen another planet, right? He'd stood on the moon and seen this lifeless, barren landscape. You know, but yet he also felt that he had something to bring as an artist, and that was now the focus of his life. And he followed that with his characteristic passion and his obsessive focus. And, you know, he didn't obsess about the past or the future, but he did obsess about his art. And I had many, many conversations with him about details in this or that particular painting. And he would call me and ask me for, you know, advice on a particular historical detail, or could I find him a photograph that might help him, you know, lay the groundwork for a painting. It was just a great experience to see him on his own journey and to hear him talk about it. And it comes through in every interview he did.
Could you put him in perspective historically for us? He was a member of the third class of astronauts. Can you tell us who some of those other 14 were, that there were some of the names people might recognize?
Well, there are a lot of famous names in there. Buzz Aldrin, Mike Collins, both from the Apollo 11 crew. Gene Cernan, who was the last man to walk on the moon. Walt Cunningham, Rusty Schweikart. Of course, Roger Chaffee, who sadly was killed in the fire that took place in 1967 in the Apollo 1 spacecraft during testing, which also killed his crewmates, Gus Grissom and Ed White. So, you know, those 14 astronauts had a lot of names in them and faces who would turn out to be, you know, really important figures in the push to the moon and even beyond.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll get back to our conversation with Andrew Chaikin as we pay tribute to the fourth man to walk on the moon, Alan Bean.
Thank you.
Welcome back, and thanks for listening to our special tribute to Alan Bean on Blue Dot. Let's get back to my conversation with author Andy Chaikin as he reminisces about his friend. And of course, we also should mention that there was the mishap with the camera on Apollo 12. Could you just tell us real briefly about that?
Oh, gosh, that TV camera. That was something that Alan once said to me, if he could go back and do it differently, he'd still like to have avoided pointing that TV camera at the sun and burning it out, you know. That was just an unfortunate thing. He was setting up the color TV camera, which had been in the descent stage of the lunar lander and had televised Pete Conrad and himself coming down the ladder to set foot on the moon. And Alan put it on a tripod and was moving it away from the LEM when he accidentally pointed it at the sun for too long, and it damaged the inside of the camera, one of the components in the camera, and it was not something that they were able to figure out how to fix during their time on the moon, and so the TV transmissions were cut short early in the first of their two moonwalks, and Alan always felt bad about that.
And kind of made up for it with all those beautiful paintings, though.
He did. He did. And, you know, the thing about Alan is that he was really a self-made man in many ways. And what I mean by that is when he decided he wanted to do something, he just researched the living heck out of it. He decided that he'd always loved the Impressionist painters, Monet in particular. And so he went to France and visited Monet's estate and took clippings from his garden. And he worked with painting instructors. And, you know, he put in so much sweat equity, so much hard work. And it showed in the paintings that he did, how much care he put into it to try and bring the kind of Impressionist perspective to the experience of being on another world, even one that looked as seemingly monochromatic as the moon. Alan came to it with an artist's eye and said, I'm going to paint the moon in a way that shows that it can be beautiful. And, you know, he did that, and he was also very focused on historical accuracy, although he did many paintings that were sort of what-if paintings. For example, the one where he took a little bit of artistic license and put he and Pete Conrad and his beloved crewmate Dick Gordon on the moon together. Dick Gordon, of course, didn't get to walk on the moon. He had to stay up in the command module, the mothership, while Alan and Pete were on the moon, and they all knew how much Dick would have loved to have done that. So Alan made it happen in one of his paintings. And it was just that great combination of accuracy and, you know, artistic beauty and Alan's own spirit that kind of melded together in all of those works.
Like all great artists, I think what he was able to accomplish with those paintings is not just show you what it looks like, but how it felt for him.
That's right. And, you know, he did one painting in particular that was specifically entitled, That's How It Felt to Walk on the Moon. Mm-hmm. And he painted himself, but he did it in a kind of rainbow pattern of colors that seemed to glow. It glowed right off the canvas. And it did a beautiful job in expressing what maybe he couldn't completely express in words, a kind of almost a state of just exhilaration and joy at being there, you know, that was in there along with the very focused professionalism that he brought to the job of being an astronaut, and which was always in his mind. He used to talk about running along on the ocean of storms, this vast volcanic plain that he and Pete Conrad explored. And at one point, they had to run quite a long distance between one crater and another. And Alan would look up into the black sky, and there, high in the sky, was the Earth. And he said to himself, "I'm really here. This is the moon. That is the Earth. I'm really here." And then he said, and then the next thought he had was, "I've got to quit doing this, because when I'm doing this, I'm not looking for rocks." That's pretty classic, Alan.
Wow. Do you have one of his paintings?
I have prints of his paintings, I'm happy to say. And I have many other keepsakes from him. And I cherish those, and I cherish my memories of visiting him in his studio and his lovely wife, Leslie. And it's been a hard time for me, actually, to process this. And, you know, even though Alan was 86 and all these guys are getting older and we've been losing them, you know, it's hard to say goodbye. And this is, in this case, especially so for me.
I feel much the same way, and I did not know him nearly as well as you did. Lastly, just one quick thing. Your book was the basis of the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, and I just wanted to say that my favorite episode of the entire series has always been That's All There Is.
Yes, a lot of people feel that way. It's got a soft spot for me, too. I remember talking to the director of that episode, and he told me that he had loved reading that chapter of my book and had really taken off from that in how he put together that episode, and that made me feel very good about it. And I think of all the chapters in my book and of all the episodes in the miniseries, that story, the Apollo 12 story, is really mostly about the really strong bond, the bond of friendship between those three astronauts, Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Alan Bean, and what they meant to each other. And it was really a story of three best friends who got to go to the moon together. So I think that comes through in the episode very nicely.
And he's played by Dave Foley.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right.
Well, I would, for our listeners, if you've never seen that episode, highly recommend it. You can stream it from somewhere, I imagine. And Andrew Chaikin's book, A Man on the Moon, my favorite chapter is Sailors on the Ocean of Storms. I listened to it again on Audible over the weekend, thinking about Alan and putting this program together.
That's great. Yeah.
Well, Andy, thanks so much for sharing your memories of your dear friend, Alan Bean, as we remember him with this special program. Thanks for all you've done to make the legacy of Apollo come alive for people like me who've been able to experience it vicariously through your book.
Well, I really appreciate that, David, and thank you for giving me a chance to talk about my dear friend.
Thanks to Andy Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon and friend of Alan Bean. Next, let's hear a passage that Andy asked me to read about his friend from the chapter Sailors on the Ocean of Storms. Bean was looking out the window. It was the first chance he'd had to relax and play tourist since arriving at the moon more than 2 days earlier. He thought about how strange it felt to orbit the moon. The strangest thing about it was the silence. There wasn't any engine noise the way there always was in an airplane. And it felt odd to see the spacecraft fly in the same direction no matter how it pointed. Orbiting the moon, Bean thought, was much more of a science fiction experience than walking on it had been. Flying in space was better than Bean had ever imagined during those long years as a rookie. Yesterday, during the rendezvous, he'd been slaving away with the backup computer and the navigation charts while Conrad flew the lunar module. They had one more burn to do, and then they would have it made. And Conrad said to him, "Why don't you just quit after this mid-course and relax and enjoy it? You can take a minute and fly this vehicle." Startled by Pete's audacity, Bean wondered, wouldn't it put them off course? No, Conrad assured him, whatever digressions they made would be easy to correct. Bean was reluctant, Surely Mission Control would know. Conrad laughed. Not on the backside of the moon, they won't. Bean realized Conrad had planned this perfectly, and for a few minutes, Bean had his hand on the crisp, responsive ascent stage. It was a moment that Bean would always remember as pure Pete Conrad. That in a small craft, somewhere over the far side of the moon, he had taken the time to share with Bean a flying experience that even most astronauts would never know. And then Bean could see Yankee Clipper out ahead, growing slowly from a point of light into a gleaming spacecraft. He watched as the command module moved from sunlight into shadow and back again, thinking, "That looks so neat." Dick Gordon did a perfect job on the docking, smooth as glass. And later, when he opened the tunnel to the LEM, all he could see was two dim figures floating in a cloud of dust. He called down, "You guys ain't gonna mess up my nice clean spacecraft." Before he would even let them into the command module, he made them take off their filthy suits. They passed them up through the tunnel and Gordon hurriedly zipped them up into their stowage bags underneath the couches. Finally, when he and Conrad got up there, Gordon was happier than Bean had ever seen him. He was scurrying around helping them stow their gear. He was offering them a drink of water. And in that moment, Bean was filled with a love for his crewmates that he had never experienced. Years later, Bean would say, his most special memories of the flight would not be about the moon or the Earth. They would be about Pete Conrad and Dick Gordon. Now Bean looked out at the bright, bleak cinder passing beyond his window. It was so utterly inhospitable. Everything in the universe has some function, Bean thought. But what is the function of the moon? Is it to make the tides? The Earth would probably get along fine without them. Maybe it was as the geologist said, the moon is here to tell us the story that had been lost forever on our own planet. Maybe the moon would tell us where we came from. Bean didn't know the answer. As Yankee Clipper circled, Bean looked, and now and then he wondered. He found himself thinking about the 6-year journey that had gotten him here. He realized now, with his neck farther out than it had ever been, that life is too precious to spend it living by someone else's rules, even the unwritten ones of the astronaut office. He would be a good astronaut. But he would do it his way. As the moon bore silent witness, he told himself, "When I get back home, if I get back home, I'm going to live my life the way I want to." Thanks for listening to our tribute to Alan Bean, Apollo astronaut, artist, husband, and father. Finally, let's hear a clip of Alan talking about life back on Earth after being to the moon from the documentary In the Shadow of the Moon.
Since that time, I have not complained about the weather one single time. I'm glad there is weather. I've not complained about traffic. I'm glad there's people around. One of the things that I did when I got home, I went down to shopping centers and I'd just go around there, get an ice cream cone or something, and just watch the people go by and think, boy, we're lucky to be here. Why do people complain about the Earth? We are living in the Garden of Eden.
Alan Bean, fourth man to walk on the moon. He passed away at age 86 on May 26, 2018. As the Apollo astronauts Bean, Pete Conrad, and Dick Gordon were flying their spacecraft Yankee Clipper with lunar module Intrepid in tow, they loved listening to music on their tape recorder. One song they played a lot was Sugar Sugar by the Archies, the number one single of 1969.
Sugar. Honey, honey, you are my candy girl, and you got me wanting you. Honey, oh, sugar, sugar. Of loving you,
I just can't believe it's true.
I just can't believe the wonder of this feeling too.
I just can't believe it's true.
Ah, sugar.
sweet a kiss could be.
I know how sweet a kiss can be.
Like the summer sunshine, pour your sweetness over me.
Pour your sweetness over me.
Thanks to our guests, Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Schweikart and Andy Chaikin, author of A Man on the Moon. I hope you enjoyed this special episode. If you missed part one, you can check it out and other episodes at mynspr.org and subscribe to us at NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that we all live on a pale blue dot. And Godspeed, Alan Bean.